This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, shortly after 9:30 in the morning here on TSN1290. The Winnipeg Jets and the Ottawa Senators, a 2 p.m. puck drop at MTS Center, a game you can hear live on TSN1290. Brian Munns, Dennis Bayak, and of course Shane Knighty will bring you the call. Got to give props to Munsey. Going to be inducted into the Saskatchewan Junior Hockey Hall of Fame.
Oh, very nice. Yeah. Congratulations.
So I saw that yesterday, so I want to give props to Munsey for that. Nice honor, of course. Trying to get a hold of Michael Russo of the Minneapolis Star Tribune. He's in Dallas as the Wild are getting set to play the Dallas Stars tonight, as you mentioned.
The Wild is, actually.
The Wild is, yes. That would be correct grammar.
I learned that from Michael Russo. He used to do the morning papers on Illegal Curve when he did the whole league. It's all, it's is, not are, because it's a singular.
Singular. It's not the Wilds.
That's right.
Yeah.
I didn't realize I was sitting beside Charles Dickens over here. I had to do that at Red River, like you have to, yeah. School, brah.
School of Hard Knocks, eh?
School. That's good. That's good insight right there with school.
It's like, how many Facebook accounts have School of Hard Knocks listed as the school that people went to?
Plenty. It's very cliche, but quite amusing at the same time.
Okay, so, you know, we're going to ask him about the Wild. The Wild has been interesting in the way that, I want to talk quickly about the Wild before we get him on here. The Wild's been interesting in their aggressiveness. You know, last year they had Jason Pominville, and they give up, you know, quite a bit for him, including a top net mining prospect. And then they re-up Pominville, and then they bring him back, and then they bring Molson in this year, excuse me. So it actually ends up being both deals with Buffalo, both deals with different management in Buffalo. But both bold moves, I think. And I think what the Wild have done is, you know, they've stocked up prospects, and you hear Granlund. Obviously, the Brent Burns trade ended up netting them Charlie Coyle, amongst others. And this is kind of, you know, we talk about the Winnipeg Jets and flexibility and all those things. I don't know if Kevin Cheveldayoff would make significant moves like this. We haven't seen yet because based on his track record, there's been limited transactions with which to, you know, base our analysis. But the organizational depth they have prospect-wise has certainly provided them with more flexibility, and that's a place we know the Jets want to get to.
Right, and I like that Chuck Fletcher went after Molson. And we've heard that Thomas Vanek might end up in Minnesota in the offseason, but I really do like the move, because the Minnesota Wild right now in seventh place, Richie, right now they match up against the Blues.
Yeah,
if you're going up against the Blues, you might as well have all the weapons possible, because the St. Louis Blues, we saw two of their best defensemen play for Team Canada at the Olympics, Alex Petrangelo and Jay Bouwmeester, and then Kevin Shattenkirk and Jackman. That group that they have there, they don't give up a lot of goals.
That's
so,
right.
You know, getting Matt Molson, another goal scorer. You mentioned Pominville.
And a bigger guy, too. They're small up
front. And a bigger guy, yep. Yeah. And really, on the wings and on even in the middle, the Wild are a very strong team, even stronger now.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
Pleased to welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show from the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Michael Russo joins us now from Dallas, where the Minnesota Wild will play the Dallas Stars later on this evening. And I think, Michael, I know one hotel that's going to get a negative review on TripAdvisor now.
Yeah, I don't know what would happen there. I mean, the ringer on my phone's working, but all of a sudden I saw a flashing light, so it looks like the phones here at this hotel are broken.
No worries whatsoever, Michael. Thanks very much for joining us. Obviously, bringing you on post-trade deadline is now the playoff push really begins in earnest. And the Wild made a splash at the trade deadline, acquiring Matt Molson. He's the big piece of the deal, as well as Cody McCormick in there. Matt Molson goes to the Minnesota Wild. What were your thoughts on the Wild move to acquire Matt Molson?
Well, I think it was a good move. I mean, this is a team that's, even though really, actually, coincidentally, from the moment the Wild went to Winnipeg, December 26th, in that real, if you remember that crazy loss, where I think it was 6-4. Since that game, the Wild have averaged almost 3 goals a game, but they're still ranked 25th in the NHL, and it is a struggle for them to score almost every night. So the Wild were looking to acquire a goaltender at the trade deadline. It looked very close that the Wild were going to go get Yaroslav Halak. And then all of a sudden, the day before, really Chuck Fletcher pulled an audible and acquired your guys' buddy, Ilya Gruzdalov. And it was a lot cheaper, one acquisition price, but it was a lot cheaper salary. And so right away, you just knew that something was up, that he was trying to save some cap space to make a move the next day. And it just seemed like the Wild were waiting on the sidelines and waiting on the sidelines. And then coincidentally, part of the package that we brought up Yaroslav Halak from Buffalo to Minnesota. He used to get Matt Molson and Cody McCormick from Buffalo. So it really looks like Chuck Fletcher on paper did a real quality job at the deadline to bring in some, you know, reinforcements and needed improvement. They're a healthy team now. They've been on fire. And now it's a matter of, can they, you know, get the guys in the right roles and create some chemistry where they can continue this, because they've been idle now for about 5 days, and so the teams behind them have really started to inch closer.
You know, Michael, you wrote in your Minneapolis Star Tribune blog that the Wild almost acquired Drew Stafford as well. Can you talk about that?
Well, yeah, it wasn't that they almost acquired him. They were going after him, and it just basically... you know, there's been a lot of dialogue between Tim Murray and Chuck Fletcher for a while now on a lot of players, and they were going hard after Drew Stafford. He's buddies with Zach Parise. Mm-hmm. But Stafford has another year left on his deal at $4 million, and to send that Minnesota's way, Tim Murray wanted a prospect and a pick for him at least. And it's just at the end, it just didn't make sense from a Wild standpoint to go out and get pay an acquisition price prospect for Stafford when you can go out and get a rental like Molson. They could probably do, you know, I think actually scores better and actually fills a much better role in the Wild than Stafford would have. So, you know, in the end, I think they just made the decision that to give up a couple second-round picks and a disgruntled winger that wanted out of here in Torrey Mitchell, that was the way to go, you know, at least in the short term. And then they'll reevaluate this summer what they want to do, if they want to go after a Thomas Vanek or try to re-sign Molson or fill other needs.
Yeah, Charlie Coyle's a guy, Michael, that's a top prospect coming through, the guy they got in return, yeah, main piece in the Brent Burns trade, and been playing center, been playing wing this year. What do you think he's looked better at? Does he look better at the wing, or does he look better in the middle?
You know, I think he looks better at the wing. Mike Yeo thinks that he's grown leaps and bounds at center this year. He just, you know, I think by all accounts, I think most people would call this a disappointing year for Charlie so far. He just hasn't, you know, he had an incredible training camp. You remember that one game in the exhibition up in Winnipeg where he really was dominant. Mm-hmm. And then the second game of the season, second period, he sprained his MCL, and he missed a month, and ever since he's come back, he just hasn't been the same player. So, you know, he's only 21 years old, and he's going to be a great player in this league, but I know they would love him to score a lot more than he does in the short term. And, you know, if he had, they probably wouldn't have had a need to go out and get him that Molson.
Michael, right before you came on, we were talking about Matt Molson, obviously, and how he adds a dimension of size to the Minnesota Wild. In your opinion, are the Wild big enough, are they strong enough, tough enough to compete with the upper echelon in the West?
No, I think that's one thing that Chuck is trying to improve here in Minnesota. You know, a lot of their top prospects are kind of smaller guys, Jason Zutters and the Cal Granlunds. Mm-hmm. And even Charlie, even though he's got size, he probably, you know, not yet is as physical as he will be one day once he really grows into his body. So, you know, I think Fletcher has really tried the last, you know, first of all, the last couple drafts to really bulk up and get a lot of size in here. Their next rung of prospects all have edge to them and grit. And, you know, the Curtis Gabriels of the world and Tyler Greivac and people like that. And now the other thing they're trying to do is, especially if it looks like the Wild are going to play Anaheim or St. Louis in the first round if they make the playoffs, is, you know, you better bulk up. And so, you know, I don't know if we'll ever see him, but they traded for Brad Winchester about a week and a half ago because he's a guy that probably wouldn't cower to a team like St. Louis. And then they bring in Cody McCormick to a right, very untraditional fourth line that was just real small and speedy, but now you put him on that line and you bulk up. And even Molson, you know, I don't think anybody's going to call him a tough guy, but obviously his size is willing to go to the net. You know, Niederreiter does that, and slowly but surely they're getting there, but they're not a team that can ever outmuscle a team like St. Louis.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290. We're joined by Minneapolis Star Tribune writer Michael Russo. He covers the Minnesota Wild.
Yeah, Michael, before we talk about goaltending, although you've alluded to it a bit in the prior questions, when we did our trade deadline preview show last week, we talked about the Wild and having it, you know, personally believing they had a need on the back end. Do you think that there was an oversight that they didn't address that?
Well, I mean, the one thing with the cap situation is they couldn't address every single need. And right now they're seven defensemen deep with John Blum in the minors. So I think that they felt like, you know, they would have basically had, if they had acquired a defenseman, basically they're real comfortable with their top six. I mean, obviously you can improve, mm-hmm, but if you acquire a defenseman, you're going to be bouncing somebody out of there. Nate Prosser's been outstanding for them.
The one guy that's been real erratic is Keith Ballard.
Yeah.
But even right now, I mean, they've been scratching Clayton Stoner, who to me doesn't really warrant that. So I just think that, and then when it came at the end of the day, they had to make a decision on what exactly they needed. They couldn't do everything. They had to get a goaltender. It felt like a scorer was much more important than a defenseman, and adding bulk up front was, you know, similarly in a guy like McCormick. And, you know, when it came to the end of the day, they just said, you know what, if they come into trouble, they have a good seventh defenseman right now, and either Stoner or Ballard, or they go to the minors to get John Plum.
Michael, we talked about the Wild goaltending situation a little bit earlier on in the interview. Obviously, you know, the Wild, you know, have, this will be their fourth goaltender that they use this year with Ilya Bryzgalov. Nicholas Backstrom's out for the year with his injury. Josh Harding's on the IR with, I guess, the side effects complications with his multiple sclerosis. You know, so they've been relying on Darcy Kemper, and he's really been doing a very fine job for the Wild since he's been the guy. But, you know, they acquired Bryzgalov. Why do you think that they chose Ilya Bryzgalov over a lot of the other available netminders?
I think it just came down to acquisition price and money. You know, if they had gone with a Martin Brodeur, which, you know, I think was probably a bit of a smokescreen and that he was probably never getting moved, or if they had gone with a Yaroslav Halak, you know, from a cap space standpoint, they wouldn't have been able to afford a guy like Matt Molson or Ford McCormick in that deal. So I think they made the easiest move that they could just to get somebody in here that they felt could be a guy that plays four or five games down the stretch. The hope in Minnesota is that Kemper could keep this up, continue to be the number one. And then at the end of the day, they really just need Bryzgalov to make a spot start here and now in the second of back-to-backs. The Wild have five sets of back-to-backs here in the last 20 games, so they're going to need Bryzgalov to play. That basically was the hope. If you go out and you bring in a Halak, I think you're looking more at him to be the number one. And I think that they feel that Kemper really deserves to continue the reins and looks like he's completely capable of doing that. Mm-hmm.
Michael, we haven't even talked to you about Mikko Koivu. He obviously had that injury, and he's coming back now. Did anybody on the Minnesota Wild step up, in your opinion? And not, obviously, you can't replace a guy like Mikko Koivu, but did you maybe notice that someone's game evolved while he was out of the lineup?
Yeah, I mean, Granlund absolutely assumes Mikko's role and has been tremendous. 20 points in his last 25 games and has just been, his first game was that December 25th game in Winnipeg. And he's just been outstanding since then. So, the big thing here is, for the first time in Mike Yeo's tenure as coach, Parisi and Koivu are actually split up now. And it's because of the job that Granlund's done with Parisi and Jason Pominville. So right now they have a huge second line in Koivu, Coyle, and Matt Molson, and it really deepens your line. Suddenly Niederreiter slots down to your third line, and you have Danny Heatley on your fourth line. Right now the Wild feel like they're deeper than they've ever been, and it's a lot of the reason is because guys like Granlund and Niederreiter have been really good since Mikko left.
There's so much talk around the league, Michael. I think one thing people overlooked or didn't really notice was Torrey Mitchell had actually made a trade request, and you had written about it, in the Star Tribune. Can you, kind of talk about why he made that request and how that was dealt with?
Well, I've got to think that he regrets it now. It's not often that a guy comes into your office with one goal and says, "I want out." Exactly what happened on the trade deadline is exactly what I wrote in my blog that morning. It's amazing. I wrote him, basically what happened is that, this guy, he signed a 3-year, $5.7 million deal on July 1st, 2 years ago, thinking that he would be the third line right wing. Well, the Wild had no clue that 4 days later that Zach Parise would choose Minnesota. So all of a sudden, Torrey slotted down. And then the other thing that happened is that Pierre-Marc Bouchard, who missed the entire year before, the Wild couldn't just rely on the fact that he'd be healthy. And then all of a sudden he was healthy to start the year. So suddenly Torrey Mitchell is just saddled on the fourth line. Ever since, the Wild have acquired Jason Pominville. They've added guys like Niederreiter, Coyle, and Granlund. So if Mitchell, at 29 years old, felt like he was being wasted, and he was on the fourth line. But the problem is that he has to be traded now. And when you're 29 years old, making less than $2 million, and you're as fast as he can, it's just so easy to throw a guy like that into a trade. So I even wrote on the blog that morning that I think that Mitchell's going to really regret this decision because he'd be such an easy throw-in. If the Wild can't trade for Stafford and go after a guy like Molson, that he'd be an easy throw-in into that deal, and that's exactly what happened. I think if I was Torrey Mitchell and I had to think it over again, I probably would have, he'd been a good soldier all year, ride out the rest of the year, play in the playoffs, and then all of a sudden you have to be traded at the end of the year. going into the last year of your deal, it would be simple to be moved. And now what happens? He winds up in Buffalo at least another year, and his first game he gets hurt the other day. So, I mean, it's just...
Wow.
I got to think Jordan Mitchell's regretting his decision.
Michael, we'll let you go on this last question. You know, obviously the Wild, they've been, you know, performing pretty steadily on the ice as of late, you know, relatively securely sort of in that first wild card spot, a 5-point lead on the Dallas Stars. How would you rate the job that head coach Mike Yao has done this season?
Yeah, he's, I mean, to me, he's done a tremendous job. I mean, this guy that was really close to getting fired potentially when the calendar turned to 2014, mm-hmm. they had lost six in a row, were getting outplayed pretty much every single night. There were lots of rumors that the Wild were going to go after guys like Peter Laviolette or Paul Maurice. And then all of a sudden the Wild caught fire, and they have the best record in the league since January 2nd. They've won five in a row. I think they're 9-2-2 in their last 13. So, you know, and he did all this without Zach Parise, without Nico Koivu, without Jared Spurgeon, without Josh Harden. And they just completely turned around their season. So, you know, to me, Mike deserves a lot of props for the way that he handled himself. He was under an immense amount of scrutiny and pressure. You know, wasn't sleeping because of the amount of stories that basically said if they'd lost to Buffalo or Washington, he was going to lose his job. They won both games, and they've been on fire ever since, and now they've put that to rest. He's still in the last year of his contract, so they got to go far. This isn't just eke into the playoffs, losing the first round. I think he's got to win a round here, but so far, so good for Mike.
I guess it's proof that sometimes the best moves are the ones you don't actually make. Michael Russo covers the Minnesota Wild for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Michael, thanks very much for doing this morning.
All right, take care.
You too. We'll see you back in Winnipeg coming up in a couple, about 6 weeks or so, 4 weeks.
No problem.
Thanks very much, Michael. Let's go to break. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Big thank you to Michael Russo for joining us to talk about the Minnesota Wild. In case you missed any of that, it will be available for download on iTunes, on TSN1290.ca, and of course on IllegalCurve.com. Going to spend a few minutes now breaking down two very good hockey teams in the Eastern Conference, that being the Pittsburgh Penguins and the Boston Bruins. Looking at them, both teams were active at the trade deadline. The Bruins probably being a little bit, well, I don't know. They weren't terribly active, either team. They were just sort of, making depth moves. Obviously, the Penguins acquired Marcel Gauch, and they also acquired Lee Stempniak. The Bruins acquired Andre Mazaros, as we mentioned earlier, and they also got Corey Potter off of waivers to really add to the depth of the defense. Look at the two teams.
I'd rather have Joey Potter from Dawson's Creek than Corey Potter.
Did they acquire the
nice reference there? That's pretty good.
And they also
I didn't know. I was thinking, who's Joey Potter?
They acquired the Sorcerer's Stone as well.
Oh, Harry Potter. Okay, I was like, what are you talking about? You know, look at those two teams,
yep.
And you compare them, and if they're, you know, it certainly, I don't think, would surprise anybody if they made it to the Eastern Conference Finals and played against each other.
Yep.
In a 7-game series between those two teams, which of the two teams are better?
I think Boston's better, Drew, because I think throughout their roster they have greater depth. And I think when you look at Crosby and Malkin, you look at two of the best centers in the National Hockey League. But when you face off against the Bruins, you have Krejci and you have Bergeron. Certainly nothing to scoff at. Are they at the level of Crosby, Malkin? No, they're not, but they're certainly at a top level. And then you look in the wings, and I know you have James Neal and Chris Kunitz, who provide, you know, great scoring ability on the left and right side, respectively, or right and left side, excuse me, the way I said it. But in Boston, you have more depth. You have Iginla, and you have Lucic, and you have Marchand, and you have, you know, Riley Smith, who nobody really talks about. And you have, you know, Carl Soderberg getting in there, and you have the fourth line depth.
Fourth line in hockey.
Yeah, and you have a better team. I think you have a better team concept of defense. You have a better team buy-in to defense. I just like the way the Bruins' four lines match up better than I do the Pittsburgh Penguins' four lines. And I like the acquisition of Marcel Gauch. I like the acquisition of Stempniak. I like Gauch more than Stempniak. And that certainly helps the Penguins' depth, and having Brandon Sutter there. But I caught a good portion of the Anaheim-Pittsburgh game last night. And Pittsburgh won in a shootout, but Anaheim was a better team, I thought. Pittsburgh isn't playing particularly well right now. And you look at their defense, and, you know, they have more depth than Boston does, especially with the Seidenberg injury, but they have nobody close to Chara. And so Chara's going to play 30 minutes a game, I think, 28, 30 minutes a game in the playoffs. He's not going to play that during the regular season, but he will in the playoffs. And then you look in net, and Rask is better more right now, I think, than Fleury. Fleury has the cup, but Fleury the past few playoffs has flamed out. And Rask has taken the team to the Stanley Cup final. Obviously, he wasn't starting when they won with Thomas there, but I think Boston's a better team. Not by a lot, but I think Boston is the better team.
It's really close, and that's kind of why we wanted to have this little quick segment about this. It came from the Wednesday trade deadline show that we did, going over all the moves, and we were talking about this, Richie and I, and Richie mentioned that we should go over this because, you know, look at the Pittsburgh Penguins and the Boston Bruins in the standing. Pittsburgh's a few points ahead of them there. I think it's 4 points, is it? And you look at these two teams, though. Pittsburgh's got the top talent.
3 points, yeah.
The top talent there, Crosby and Malkin. I mean, Crosby and Malkin, nobody has Crosby and Malkin.
That's right.
There's no team in the league that has that. Even Taves and Kane and Sharp and Hossa, not on the same level as Crosby and Malkin. But when you look down the roster, and, you know, I mentioned the fourth line, and I always love to talk about that because, really, that fourth line has been together for so long. Gregory Campbell and Sean Thornton and then Paille on there. And you look at why that's so important. It's because they can roll that line out and 10 minutes a game. But the Boston Bruins really, I think, if you look at the two teams and what they're maybe what separates them, you mentioned Tuukka Rask in goal. And Marc-Andre Fleury, we got to give Marc-Andre Fleury credit. He's had a good year. He's had a strong year.
No, but his regular season play has never been the issue for the most part.
Well, right. But I'm just saying, if you look at how these teams will match up, yeah, you're right. He's got to do it in the playoffs. You're right, Drew. He this year, and that's a big year for him, because going forward, he's not an old guy. Like, we think he's still got a lot of years left in him, but he has to prove that. They have to think about this going forward. And, you know, we talked about whether they should acquire a Vanek or a Kessler or whatever. Not necessarily. Really, the problem with this team, similar to the Minnesota Wild in the sense, is that they need to round out that decor there. And Olli Maatta has done a great job. And you asked us that on Wednesday and said it's ridiculous to say a 19-year-old is your number one defenseman because you've got Paul Martin and Brooks Orpik and Rob Scuderi. Those are your veteran guys. But really, you've got to kind of insulate his minutes in the sense that you can't expect in the playoffs going against the Boston Bruins, you can't expect Olli Maatta to play 30 minutes a game. It's just something that for him it's too difficult to do at his age. So that to me the special teams battle goes to Pittsburgh, but overall I think really I have to give the edge to Boston because of the depth that they have on forward. And I think Malkin and Crosby and Neal and all that, they have the advantage as far as they've got the star power, they've got the superstar power. But Patrice Bergeron, as an all-around forward, is probably, with the exception of maybe Jonathan Toews, we saw how good he was in the Olympics. I think if they play in the playoffs, it'll be, I wouldn't be surprised if it goes to 7 games, but I think Boston comes out on top.
Let's head to break. When we come back, we're going to be joined by James Gordon from the Ottawa Citizen to talk more about this afternoon's Jets-Sens game. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to The Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
2 hours down, 1 hour to go. Welcome back to The Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290, TSN1290.ca. This segment is brought to you by Dr. Les Rikus and the Linden Market Dental Center. Whether an elite athlete or a weekend warrior, wearing a proper fitting, custom-made mouth guard designed for you by Dr. Les Rikus and the Linden Market Dental Center, it's an essential part of your protective equipment. Give yourself peace of mind protection as well as facial, teeth, and mouth protection. Contact the Linden Market Dental Center at 204-487-2226 or reach them online at LindenMarketDentalCenter.com. This afternoon, 2 p.m., the Winnipeg Jets and the Ottawa Senators will face off at MTS Center. A game you can hear live on TSN 1290, online at TSN1290.ca. Key matchup for both teams, as we've discussed. Probably pretty much a playoff game for both teams, as they both are on the outside looking in. And a loss to either team will certainly affect their chances at making it into the postseason contest. James Gordon from the Ottawa Citizen, we're trying to get a hold of him momentarily to bring him on to talk about the game from the Ottawa perspective. But, you know, you guys mentioned prior when we started this earlier in the show that you think that the Jets can take, you think it's going to be a high-scoring game between the two teams this afternoon?
Yeah, Drew, I think, you know, Ottawa likes to open it up a bit. You know, they may say they want to play more defensive, and the Jets seem to kind of go along with that opening up if it's presented to them. So that's why I see today's game being this afternoon's game being a 4-3 kind of game. You know, some goals, some turnovers, some mistakes, and that usually makes for an exciting game. And as I said earlier in the show, you know, really a must-win game. You know, we keep saying this, but really a must-win game for both teams. Ottawa loses today. I mean, they might be done already, but they are especially done. So that's going to be a tough one for sure.
Yeah, Richie, I was having this argument with someone. Someone said that a lot of these afternoon games, and there was one obviously last weekend, mm-hmm. Someone said that these afternoon games aren't that exciting and all this. I think I disagree with that. I love the afternoon games. But I don't think that this one is going to be a boring game for the simple fact that both of these teams need this win. And you know, it's the part of the year where all of these games matter. And right now the Ottawa Senators, they can't afford to give up those points, and neither can the Winnipeg Jets. They can't.
Trying to get a hold of James Gordon, the Ottawa Citizen. We'll keep trying at that. In the meantime, guys, you know, let's keep talking about the game right now. We'll do the other thing later. We'll try and get a hold of James Gordon, as I mentioned. You know, you look at the Jets and you look at their forward lines. They switched them up, obviously, last game, and we don't know what the roster is going to look like for today's game because there is no pregame skate. You know, would you put John Albert, they called him up on an emergency recall basis, would you put John Albert back in, you know, he's a centerman, so would you put John Albert back into the Jets lineup, maybe end the experiment of Michael Frolik as a centerman, put him back to the more comfortable wing spot for today's game?
Yeah, probably, Drew. I mean, you know, playing center is a whole different ballgame, to face-offs, to defensive coverages, to... there's many other things too, just how you're going on down the ice and how you're playing. For Michael Frolik, who's never really played any center in the National Hockey League, I think that's a difficult task to undertake. So I would push him back to the wing, and if you have a natural center, go with that natural center and let him play in that role. Because, you know, John Albert is a guy who's not performed on, you know, not been offensively dynamic in the AHL, but he has played center before, and that level of comfort maybe will help. But this is getting back to the original issue, and that depth issue, especially up the middle, and they're not Detroit by any means. But I do think that you want to get guys back to their natural positions, because when you have, this is the thing, you know, when you have Frolik playing center and you've had Setoguchi also playing left wing for long extended periods. Now last game he was playing with Frolik, so he's playing the right side, if I recall correctly, and they had Hallstrick on the left side, I believe. But you've had so many guys playing out of position, or some guys playing out of position at times, and what happens when guys play out of positions is they're unfamiliar with that. And when they're unfamiliar with it, what happens? They make mistakes because they haven't done that before. The NHL game moves at a far faster pace, you know, than it looks like on TV or even from high in the stands. And when you have that much less time to make a move and you're not used, you know, even in a breakout, right? If you're in a breakout and the center has a different role than the winger, how many times have you done that? Maybe in the past you've done it, but, you know, probably not a lot. And so if you do something over and over and over again, of course, what happens? You get better at it. It doesn't mean those guys can't make breakout passes or can't come support the winger on the boards, but when you don't do it as often, maybe you go a little too high in the zone. Maybe you go a little bit too low in the zone. Maybe you don't time it right. The chemistry is off with the wingers because you haven't played that position before. So it's very difficult. So I would probably lean towards having centers play center and wingers play wing.
What's unfortunate about Michael Frolik playing at center, and this is obviously a result of Mark Scheifele being injured, is that you shuffle up the lines and the lines were playing well. And you had Michael Frolik playing very well, mm-hmm. with Andrew Ladd and Brian Little, and you had the Evander Kane, Mark Scheifele, Blake Wheeler line playing some pretty good hockey as of late. So now the Mark Scheifele injury puts all of these wingers and centers in positions that they... it's not that they're not comfortable with it necessarily. They are not comfortable with it, but it's more so that you're messing up a good thing, right? And you can't really do anything about it. Mark Scheifele goes down for the rest of the regular season, and you're in a position where you either have to put John Albert on the fourth line or use Michael Frolik at center and keep Jim Slater on the fourth line. So it's unfortunate, but we don't know that Albert's playing today, unless something's been reported.
No, because there's no game day skate.
Right, so he might go in there. They might, and again, you might be trying to get a little bit more offense. Maybe you pull Tangrady or Peluso out to get a little bit more offense, because John Albert has been playing well for St. John's in the A.
if Albert goes in at center, or if the Frolik as center experiment ends, do you move Frolik back up with Ladd and Little and maybe put Kane with Wheeler, with Jokinen in the middle, and then make your third line with Byfuglien and Setoguchi sort of similar to how it had been?
Yeah, I don't mind that idea. I mean, there's not a ton of flexibility. I mean, the question, maybe alternatively, I think that's good. You could possibly move even Byfuglien up with Little and Lado. That didn't really work in the short experiment earlier in the year. I don't mind the idea of getting a playmaker in Wheeler with Jokinen and Kane, because you need somebody who can pass on that line, because the other two guys are not, you know, are not proficient in terms of passing. And, last game's goal notwithstanding, they're not going to be the guys who are moving that puck quickly. So they're going to be the guys who are firing the puck on the net. If you can get a passer there, that'll help.
A passer like Blake Wheeler, you're saying?
Like Blake Wheeler.
Right. And
Dustin Byfuglien's a really good passer, too.
Sure.
Maybe they try him on that line with those guys. Why not?
There's certain games that sort of seem
Byfuglien's been sleeping, so you got to get him going. So you got to move Byfuglien around, I think.
Well,
because he's been doing nothing.
Well, I mean, he had.
Again, he's not on the back end, so he's not killing you a lot of the time. But you got to get him in a different position to succeed, I think, instead of just putting him on the third and just saying, okay, whatever.
There's certain games, certain opponents that seem better suited, for Dustin Byfuglien's game. I mean, we know he's not gonna beat you with his speed.
Yeah, today wouldn't be one of those games.
That's what my question was.
Yeah, today wouldn't be one of those games because it's a fast team, transition team, quick game, and sometimes he has trouble keeping up. But I would like to, you want to light a spark under Dustin Byfuglien, and I think that's going to be one of the keys, Drew. It's good that you brought this up, because if you're going to lose a guy like Mark Scheifele, there's going to be an offensive output that you need to replace. And I know, and I realize that it doesn't have to be, one guy. And it's not going to be Ole Jokinen, but it certainly can be Devin Setoguchi, Dustin Byfuglien, Michael Frolik. They can certainly compensate for it if they all step up. So getting Byfuglien going and Setoguchi as well, although it'd be difficult to get him going, it's been tough, is going to help if this team wants to, be serious here. They need to have other guys going. And the top line's performed as a whole pretty well this year. Just saying the Little, Ladd, Wheeler, those three guys. But, Jokinen better than last year, but still nothing special. Kane's had a tough year. Byfuglien really hasn't had a good year either. Frolik's been really solid for what he is. Setoguchi's had a bad year. So a couple of those guys have had a bad year. Hey, the season isn't over. Get going. And I'm sure that's what Paul Maurice wants to do. He wants to get the guys who've been struggling and guys who have offensive talent to start to produce.
Goaltending for today's game. We haven't seen Al Montoya in... I don't believe he's played since the...
Well, you're not going to replace Pavlik right now, Drew. Pavlik's going too well. It's going great. It's great last game. Pavlik's going well. You're not replacing Pavlik right now.
So you're not seeing Montoya until there's a back to back situation. Pretty much the Sunday. I think there's a Sunday Monday back to back next Sunday. So they have Sunday against. I think they have Sunday against Dallas, and then Monday against Colorado, if I'm not mistaken.
Or maybe I'm not sure about that. But I do know that you may see Montoya. You may see Montoya after travel or whatever. Maybe you're a poor game by Pavlik. But today's game, based on the way Pavlik's playing, Pavlik's in. I'm not sure if that's been formally announced.
It hasn't been.
It's a Pavlik game. It's playing too well right now. I mean, people have to criticize Pavlik. But since Maurice has been hired, he's been very good. No complaints there. He's been very good. I know that's gonna get the masses going. Everybody likes to criticize him. And, hey, he didn't play well at the beginning of the year. And part of that falls on his shoulders. Part of that falls on the team defense and other things. But since Maurice has been hired and the team defense has improved, I think he has improved as well. I don't think those two things are mutually exclusive. And ride him. Let your guy go. And if he struggles, then you put him Montoya and you'll get a good performance out of him too.
And earlier this season, when Al Montoya was starting three straight games, he deserved it because mm-hmm. Pavlik wasn't playing well and Montoya was playing well. So right now it's a situation Montoya hasn't done anything wrong. It's just Andre Pavlik is playing well, and he deserves. Right. You go with the hot goalie. And against the LA Kings, there was a reason why he was the first star. He kept that game close. He did his job, and mm-hmm. it's a team that might be struggling to score goals, but they could still score goals. I think there's a lot of players on that LA Kings team that should have more goals. Mike Richards only has 9 goals this year. That's a guy that you usually pencil in for 20. So, yeah, Pavlik is no complaints from me on his game over the last, I would say, really, probably since Noel was
since
let
January
go.
12th,
really.
Yeah. Since January 12th, since Maurice was hired, he has stepped up his game. And the team stepped up in front of him, I think, especially defensively. That Islanders game was a look back at the old Jets. because the breakaways and the chances they give up, you know, and all that stuff, and the speed that Islanders were able to generate was not something, not the way the Jets want to play.
To this point, Brian Munns just sent me an email. He says, yesterday, Paul Maurice said it's the same roster as last game, so it will be Pavlik. And if it's the same roster, I guess that means that John Albert's not checking into the lineup, mm-hmm. and they're going to continue with the Michael Frolik experiment at center.
It'll be interesting to see if the rest of the line stay the same, because the team didn't touch the puck last game. They touched the puck three times in the game, for God's sake. I mean, so if he's going with that same roster, he better hope this is, something changes in terms of performance here, because the Lions weren't going, and the team they were playing was obviously great, and it was a mismatch. Probably the biggest, the most dominating performance of a visiting team in town this year, I thought. And so you better come out, and if they're not shuffling the lines, then those guys better step up, because that was a tough performance on Thursday.
Well, the biggest difference, obviously, will be that the LA Kings aren't the opponents anymore.
And that's right.
And it's the Ottawa Senators instead.
That's right. But even when they limited times where they actually had the puck, they weren't generating anything. And you know, the Kings aren't going to beat you with speed. They're going to beat you with size and taking away space. So it's going to be a different game today. Yeah. You better hope. But you're right. You know, better hope against a team with speed and certainly not very good defensively. You can take advantage of those deficiencies on the other end.
Let's head to break. We're going to continue to try and track down James Gordon. But when we come back, 10-year anniversary of a dark day in the NHL. We'll discuss it. Steve Moore, Todd Bertuzzi. You're listening to the Legal Curve Hockey Show on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, the podcast on TSN1290.ca.
In the morning, welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290, online at TSN1290.ca. Discussing 10 years. It was 10 years ago today. It's amazing it was 10 years ago already. That part is amazing in and of itself, that the Steve Moore, Todd Bertuzzi incident happened on the ice in Vancouver. I believe, here we go. This is the audio from 10 years ago today.
Bertuzzi comes over to have words with Moore. Todd shadowing him, having words with Moore. Keeping right after him. Bertuzzi challenging Moore. Grabs a hold of him and throws a right hand at him. A cheap shot sucker punch from Todd Bertuzzi. And now everybody's into it at center ice. Brad May is throwing punches with Kurt Sauer.
Somebody's hurt here.
Well, I think that's Moore, who got cold cocked by Todd Bertuzzi. And Moore is laying prone at center.
Yeah, what happened is he hit him from behind and then drove his face into the ice. And there's real serious, there's real concern here.
Todd Bertuzzi on Steve Moore 10 years ago today. One of, you know, this incident is, to me, is still clear as day in my mind. And, you know, of all the on-ice incidences, and there's been plenty of them, and we always go apoplectic over each and every one, you know, each and every headshot and each and every bad check and everything else. To me, this one is still the gold standard. It's still the worst on-ice incident. It's worse than Marty McSorley on Donald Brashear in my mind. I don't know if that's because of the ramifications and the fact that Steve Moore never played another hockey game after that, you know, assault by Todd Bertuzzi. But it bothers me. And, I mean, every time I see Todd Bertuzzi and people praise him for whatever he's done in his career, and he's been, you know, getting contracts in Detroit on a one-year basis for the last number of years, every time he signs a new one-year contract, it does bother me that he's continuing to play and Steve Moore hasn't played a game since the day that the incident happened.
Well, you know, it's been a long time, you know, 10 years. I remember watching this game, Drew, and it was
the day before the trade deadline, if I'm not mistaken.
It was Colorado was dominating them. I think it was
7-2.
Yeah, 7 or 8-2. That was the year they had Kriya and Solani on the squad. Never really came together, that team, but what he did was terrible. I think that's been well documented. And the sucker punch, I don't like. Driving his head into the ice after, even worse. Or maybe not even worse, but just as bad. Todd Bertuzzi never really, you know, he had that apology with the emotion. He's never really opened up and made you feel bad for him at all about this. Like, he hasn't, you know, feel bad at me in the sense that, you know, he made a mistake. He has great guilt. He never really was able to say the right thing. And I think that's always, that always stands out to me. He never said, you know, I feel terrible about what happened and I'm going to speak, I'm going to be actively speaking about something like this. I'm going to speak to young people about not doing what I did and all. And he hasn't really done any of that. And if you even if you watch him in the 24/7 HBO feature, didn't he look like a pained individual? I'm not saying it's all to be traced back to this incident, but I'm sure this incident isn't, you know, isn't something he doesn't think about. And he just seems like a guy who hasn't been able to address it and deal with it. And he's never really been the same player since. I mean, Todd Bertuzzi at that point in time was a dominating National Hockey League player. With him, Brendan Morrison, and Marcus Naslin was one of the best lines in the National Hockey League. It went up against, you know, Arnett, Sakura, and Eliash, and like during those times. And there were some other great lines in the NHL at that time. And he's been, you know, shortly after that, he became a shadow of himself. He got traded to Florida.
For Roberto Luongo.
Roberto Luongo, and then to Detroit. And Detroit, I don't, you know, they sign him, and for whatever reasons, because he's really not that productive of a player anymore. But that's besides the point here. He's not a likable guy. He seems kind of like a very reserved, even angry guy. I want to let Izzy get here in here on Bertuzzi's perspective, because I want to talk about Moore after.
I was going to say, you sounded awfully sympathetic to Todd Bertuzzi, but we'll talk about the Moore.
What do you mean?
Just that you feel that you, the way you describe it, you almost feel bad for Bertuzzi.
I don't feel bad for Bertuzzi. I'm just saying I don't think he's addressed, and it seems like a guy who hasn't been able to come to grips with something like that. I don't feel bad for him. I think I'd be putting words in my mouth.
Okay, I apologize in that case.
I mean, you know, he did a terrible thing, and he has to deal with it and live with it. But I just think he hasn't. He seems like a pain individual, hasn't been able to deal with it, and I think that's caused further pain, just from a, you know, from afar.
Right, and it's the 10-year anniversary, and that's why TSN. That's why we're talking about it, first of all. But that's why TSN is doing the Trials and Tribulations 3-part series on TSN. I haven't had a chance to watch it yet, but no, this was a big deal, and it's. It's still a big deal. And, you know, Richie, you mentioned, I tend to agree with you. I think, you know, this lawsuit, is, I believe it's September 8th here.
That's right.
That begins, and, you know, the NHL is going to be involved. And I think Steve Moore is looking for $38 million in damages. And, you know, you kind of have to talk about it. And I don't think, Richie, you know, when you talk about Bertuzzi, I don't think you feel sorry for Bertuzzi. I think what Richie's saying is that really it's affected him in a way where he's kind of bottled it up, and he also probably hasn't let it go. And this is something, though, it's easy for us, you know, have the radio show and fans to kind of chime in about this, but really it's something, this changed both of their lives, and you can't change that. Steve Moore was never able to play professional hockey again at the level that he wanted to play at. Steve Moore, you got to remember too, he was a good player. He wasn't just a guy that was, you know, he was kind of a journeyman. He was a young guy at the time. His entire career, I'm not saying that he's Wayne Gretzky. I'm just saying that Steve Moore had a career ahead of him. And how that happened, it's the severity of what happened, right? And we were watching this, and TSN's been playing it a lot, obviously. But it was because of the fact that he was stretchered off, and he really never recovered. He's never recovered. And it's something that, sure, you want to say, you know, the NHL's gotten better and all that, and then we see the Zach Cassian hit, and it seems like nothing's changed, right?
Well,
Brendan Dillon, but the point being that this, you have to be able to learn something from this, and you know, in hockey there is obviously a code amongst the players. That stuff stays on the ice or whatever. The problem with this was of all of the what surrounded it, and the bounty and all that. Not that there was not necessarily a bounty, but they wanted to get revenge for what happened. And it's really difficult, again, for us to say that, you know, Steve Moore should move on, because he obviously can't. When there's a lawsuit that's about to start, he's been waiting 10 years for this, right?
Well, he lost his career. He lost what he expected to make him enough money to live comfortably for, you know, the rest of his life. Richard, you wanted to address it from Steve Moore's perspective, or what you think? You know, obviously you don't know Steve Moore, but you know.
No, I had a chance to interview him with Hustler about a month ago, and his foundation, his for concussion awareness. Steve Moore has a lot of resentment for the situation, which I understand. There's a resentment towards the Colorado Avalanche, too, if you speak to him. the fact he was a free agent after the year, and they didn't take care of him. They just kind of threw him out on the street and said, you know, deal with it. So he had to see doctors, not through the NHL, not through, I guess, the ability for them to expedite the medical process. So, you know, and he never played again, and he kind of feels like the NHL abandoned him. And the organization, you know, the way the Avalanche handled it didn't seem to be in a classy manner. And based on his, you know, his story, and he's faced difficulties, and I don't think he feels like he has the necessary help to do it. And I understand that, and I feel terrible for the fact that this guy was going to have a 10-year career, probably in the National Hockey League. You know, he's a fringe checking guy, but he was a, you know, he was a bit of a you know, the Ken Linsman type player. I'll put it that way, and he kind of get under your skin and do all that stuff, and.
There's nothing to say prior to this incident, you know, that he couldn't have, like you said, yeah, had a 10-year career playing a third or fourth line role.
Right, but the point, for me, throughout all this, he doesn't seem to have moved on either. And I'm not saying forget. I'm not even asking to forgive. I just think that he seems to be locked into that time that, you know, that 10 years ago as well. If you interview him, there doesn't seem to be any kind of, you know, what's happened has happened. It's, I'm not happy about it. It's certainly affected my life and changed things about the way I would have lived my life. And if you read articles now, he's doing a lot better than he was before. But he just seems to have harbor a lot of anger and not have the ability in not really move on. And I'm not saying, oh, forget about it. This is a terrible thing that happened to him. I understand that. But for him to enjoy his life a little more, he has to be able to move on from this a little bit, and he doesn't seem to have, and that's sad to see, really. And it both of these guys don't seem to have moved on from this incident in different ways. And Moore, obviously, you feel sympathy for Moore. For Bertuzzi, you're just troubled by everything that's happened. But to me, that's what I take from this whole thing. This tragic incident, this terrible incident, has resulted in both guys really being kind of locked in the past almost. And I know Moore's done stuff for awareness, and he's done some good things, don't get me wrong. And I think Bertuzzi ought to have done those things too. Maybe not if he extended the olive branch and Moore didn't take it, fine, and with Moore's entitled not to. But then he should have been doing it on his own, and he wasn't, and he hasn't. And there's still time. But Moore also seems locked into an angry place almost. And you like to see him get past that, to be able to enjoy things a little more. Just my personal opinion. I don't know either of these guys personally. I've spoken to Moore through interview, in a short interview. Never talked to Todd Bertuzzi. But that's just from afar, my perspective.
Let's go to break. I want to come back. I want to talk a little bit more about this. I want to ask about the NHL, and did they drop the ball on this incident? You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
Listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, the podcast on TSN 1290.ca.
10:30 in the morning. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. Online, TSN1290.ca. This segment is brought to you by Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club. For over 25 years, Rumors has been Winnipeg's home for the best in stand-up comedy. To purchase tickets or for a list of performers and showtimes, visit rumorscomedyclub.com. Tonight at Rumors, and I've just been reliably informed, very few tickets, a couple of tickets, have been released just now to see Chris Kattan at Rumors. So if you missed out on the opportunity to see Chris Kattan because all the shows were sold out, a few tickets have just been released, so you can get them at rumorscomedyclub.com or by calling Rumors at 204-488-4520. Continuing our discussion about the Steve Moore Todd Bertuzzi incident, happened 10 years ago today on the ice at GM Place in Vancouver, what then would have been called GM Place.
That's
in
right.
Vancouver.
Yeah.
You know, to me, part of the problem I have with this, and you know, we talk about how, you know, Steve Moore feels let down by the Avalanche organization, sort of, you know, didn't re-sign him, didn't help him through the trauma after the incident. To me, it seems like the whole NHL sort of blackballed him. That
how?
You know, I think that the NHL as an entity has some sort of obligation to step in and help him when this incident occurs. Not necessarily every single year, but they have an obligation to not just sort of try and sweep him under the rug, you know, after it happened. Think about it. It happened, the incident happened, and it was stories for a couple days. And then Bertuzzi suspended for the rest of the year, so the NHL sort of puts him away and, you know, out of sight, out of mind for the remainder of that of the season. And then really, I mean, the next year comes around, and how often did you hear about Steve Moore? You know, did you see anything?
We're talking about 10 years later.
I know we're talking about it 10 years later.
The only thing I see the NHL ought to have done is step up for the medical bills and medically help him.
That's what I'm talking about. Financial. They should have been
medically helped him, you know, the financial bills and the medical bills that he had to obviously incur. And I assume he had insurance in the States, but based on the, you know, the money he was making. But I don't know. And from that point of view, yeah, the NHL should have. And thinking back now 10 years, concussions weren't as big of an issue as they are now. Sure, I don't disagree with that, Drew, that the NHL should have at least covered those bills while he was, you know, rehabbing and doing all those things. I think he was in the hospital for like 5 months.
Well, he broke 3 vertebrae in his neck. I mean, so there's going to be significant recovery time.
So,
obviously.
I mean, that those things, I think that they should have at least ensured that he was healthy, or as healthy as he could be at the time, and on the way to recovery.
If Steve Moore, so let's say Todd Bertuzzi is the sort of third line, fourth line depth guy, and Steve Moore is the, at that time, superstar. I mean, Todd Bertuzzi at that time was a superstar in the NHL. And the shoe's on the other foot. And it's the depth guy, it's the you know, fringe player who body slams and sucker punches the superstar. How does that change this incident?
It's a good question, because you'd hope that there wasn't any difference.
Let me interrupt right there, Ezzy. Do you think there would have been a difference?
I actually do think there would have been, and I know it kind of sounds sick to say that, but I think really if you did have a situation where one of the superstar players were injured, you would first of all hear about it a lot more often, right? And you can't really, it's tough to go back to that time and remember how it was covered either by the media or all that, but if they had an ability to help him out more and they didn't, and he's resentful for that, it is a black mark on the NHL and the Colorado Avalanche organization. Now, as far as the organization that he started, the foundation that he started, that's all good. This is a part of hockey that hockey has a bright future ahead of it, but these types of incidents and the amount of concussions that we still see, that's the MO of the NHL and everybody, all of the stakeholders in the NHL. We want to get rid of these concussions. We want to get rid of these cheap shots. And as far as back to Steve Moore and kind of how he was treated by the NHL, I don't know necessarily, Richie, that they swept it under the rug, but I definitely also think Steve Moore hasn't been, coming up with the 10-year anniversary of Steve Moore being injured, that's all fine and dandy, but where was all of this 7-8 years ago?
If Steve Moore hits Todd Bertuzzi like that, does Steve Moore get contract? And I mean, let's say he was still capable of playing in the NHL, you know, and he still had the skill set. Does he stay around in the NHL as long as Todd Bertuzzi has, or does he get blackballed?
Well, I mean, probably he may get blackballed, Drew, because if you can score in the National Hockey League, you're a commodity no matter your history. If you can provide value to an owner, somebody will sign you. If Steve Moore was essentially replaceable, then probably nobody would have touched him. And if somebody would have touched him, it would have been in a very minimum deal. But the guy wasn't, you know, making big money at the time. And he was a checking guy, and he was, again, it was a Ken Linsman type. But I mean, you know, like, it wasn't exactly the most well-liked the way he played.
Right.
And so that wouldn't exactly have endeared him to every team also. You know, if you develop enemies in other teams, then there you go. Some players don't want you on that team. Maybe management doesn't want to sign you because of that.
And well, the number of guys in the NHL who aren't well-liked by other teams is a long list.
Right, but we're talking like Matt Cook kind of stuff here.
Matt Cook's still in the league.
Well, but Matt Cook can score a little bit, but he's also a tremendous penalty killer, and he's a certain value he can provide. I'm not saying he wouldn't have been able to do that. If he can provide a value to an NHL team, somebody will sign you. Somebody will sign you.
You know, should the NHL, I mean, is obviously this trial is going to start coming up, they suppose, in September. There's going to be a trial. Mm-hmm. And I mean, he's suing the NHL for $38 million.
It's quite a big sum there.
I don't really know where, I mean, I don't know where you come up with that number, because that number isn't based in reality, because Steve Moore, I mean, you know, was never going to make $38 million in the course of his NHL career.
No, I mean, if you say he plays another 10 years, just for example, 10 years and makes $2 million a year, which is high.
Yeah.
$2 million a year for 10 years.
Back then, it's even higher.
Right,
I mean, yeah.
Even, you know, now, even for based on what it probably would provided, but right around the market. Just say $2 million for 10 years. That's $20 million. That's before tax. So say he makes 11, 12 of that, so net $12 million. Some of his medical bills, things like, I mean, so look, $38 million kind of is out of nowhere.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think you do, I mean, and this is a bit of, you know, and obviously I'm sure he's getting legal advice that's far superior to my fake legal advice, but I think that you sort of, he does lose a little bit of credibility, I think, Steve Moore, when you sue for that amount of money.
I mean, you know, that's a whole different ballgame, Drew. That's in the civil realm, and yeah, I don't know what the precedents are for that. People may ask high numbers, and what we don't know. I mean, I don't really know what they're presenting.
I know, and I'm not asking for a legal opinion on that. I'm just looking at as a, you know, as a lay person, as a, you know, as a fan of the game. I'm like, you know, and obviously there's punitive damages and actual damages and all that nonsense. And I don't want to get into that. I'm just saying, you know, as a hockey fan, I remember Steve Moore. Where's he getting this $38 million? Is that a cash grab? You know, what's up with that? Where's he getting $38 million from?
And that might be a good illustration of how really he feels that this incident has negatively affected his life. $38 million. There's the price tag for what happened to him, right? Mm-hmm. 10 years later, he's saying $38 million is what I'm
going surprised through. This hasn't been settled, I will say that. I mean, first of all, it's been 10 years, guys. How is this not, I mean, it's not in a trial yet. It's been 10 years. I'm shocked it has not settled.
Well, I mean, you look at it from the Vancouver, I mean, he's obviously taking the Canucks to court as well and the NHL.
I'm saying, why would he want this to go away?
It's the previous Canucks ownership at this point in time.
It's John McCaw.
Yeah.
But I mean, John McCaw, who was not very involved with the team, by all accounts. Like, he's a bit of a recluse, apparently. He lives in Seattle.
Yeah.
Sold the team since, obviously, as you mentioned, to Francesco Aquilini, I believe that was the transaction. But that's odd. It's also odd that, you know, if you go to trial, this is going to be aired out. I mean, Steve Moore doesn't care, but the rest of them, Vancouver and the NHL.
Well, Bill Daly and Gary Bettman are both going to have to testify, apparently. I mean, just for the optics of it.
That's the point, right?
Just for the optics. You don't want this trial to be, you know, like you said, it's been 10 years, and I mean, yeah.
He wasn't blackballed before, though. He'll be blackballed after.
Obviously. But, I mean, it's been 10 years, and we're, you know, we don't talk, I mean, it gets talked about, you know, generally on anniversaries of it, like everything else, you know, when it fades from memory, it comes up when it's an anniversary or whatnot. But this trial is going to be in the front pages of the paper. It's going to be covered by the hockey world every single day for however many days the trial lasts. I mean, it's been the trial date set for September 8th. I don't know how long it's scheduled to last, but it's front page news.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, this black mark from the NHL, you know, is going to be front and center again. And, you know, what's the, I mean, you know, I don't know. Maybe Steve Moore is being unreasonable if there had been settlement discussions. I don't know.
We don't know.
Maybe the NHL. Maybe the NHL said, no way in hell are we paying you a dime. We want to take this to court because we're going to win. I don't know that either. But I'm saying, just from the public relations aspect of it, you would think you'd want the NHL to make this go away rather than have to air, you know, air the grievances and air the dirty laundry in front. Because, I mean, there was a lot of talk that there was a bounty on Steve Moore from the Canucks, because this all stems back to his hit on Marcus Naslund in a game earlier in Colorado.
I mean, it was a cheap hit. It was a cheap hit. If you remember the game, Naslund's going down the left wing, crosses over the blue line, is falling, and Moore follows through on Naslund while he's falling and hits him. Naslund right in the head. And it was a cheap hit. There's no doubt about it. I mean, what obviously Patrizzi did was cheaper. No question about that. No question. Sucker punches are cheaper. And the driving of him to the ice. But that was a cheap hit by Moore on Naslund. And that's what precipitated all this, obviously. And then Vancouver at that time was trying to create, I'm not justifying it, I'm just explaining, was trying to create an identity. And they wanted to make sure they stuck up for their, you know, probably their best, not probably, it was their best scorer. Bertuzzi still was a little more of a passer than a scorer, I think, at that time. I mean, Bertuzzi in 2003, 2004 was just under a point a game, but he had 43 assists, 17 points. He was always looked to pass a little more than shoot, but he could score. And they wanted to protect their top guy. Naslund was never somebody who's going to engage in too much physical contact, right? He was a sniper, one of the best wrist shots of his era.
Right.
And that's where it all went down. And then, you know, and the other issue is when, as if that game was 4-3, it probably doesn't happen. I'm almost sure it doesn't happen.
You're right, because it's a blowout.
Yeah.
It's also worth noting that Steve Moore fought earlier in that game where, you know, if you believe in this code and you believe in the honor and everything else, you know, that should
Which I do.
That should have, you know, gotten him off the hook from any future retribution. But the score of the game, the fact that Colorado was absolutely dominating Vancouver on home ice in Vancouver, I think is certainly a contributing factor to why Todd Bertuzzi did what he did.
And even if you're going to go after him again after he dropped the gloves, okay, just don't sucker punch him. That's the problem, right? So you didn't see it. He was skating away from him. I understand that, but you didn't see it. If it wasn't face-to-face, remember, you know, it's like Ty Domi, who's well-liked, obviously, in this town after playing for the Jets by the fans, when he sucker punched Scott Niedermayer. So Niedermayer didn't see it, and you can't do that.
It would be nice that after this lawsuit, they can move on. And, you know, you mentioned Steve Moore really has almost let it consume his life, Richie, and you mentioned that he's not really going to be truly happy until he accepts the apology and accepts the fact that it has been 10 years, time to move on. But really, this trial, what it will do, even though this will be part of their lives, it really will let them both move on, because they know that the legal aspect of this is over. And it's the amount, it might be that amount, it might be something less, but they can move on after. Because this is something that, you know, you hope that the NHL will, not just the players, but everybody involved, coaches, will learn something from it, hopefully. There's still going to be incidences, I should say, that are happen in the NHL. But this, I think, was probably the most gruesome thing ever to happen on a rink.
Well, at least in our consciousness or our relative.
Yeah, I mean, when, you know, it's just the sucker punch. It's just, you can't sucker punch a guy.
Right.
That's the thing. I mean, the thing about, we mentioned the Domi Niedermayer, and there's been other ones, two sucker punches. But if you know, those things could have resulted just as bad. I mean, the one thing, obviously, pushing his head into the ice after two didn't help. I think it was already out at that point. So I'm not sure how the vertebrae, when the vertebrae, I assume probably in the slamming into the ice, I believe that's what it was, right?
Yeah, I think he was out. He was out after getting the punch in the back of the
head.
That's
the thing. You know, like I've been sucker punched before. You get a concussion. I've got a concussion from a sucker punch before. It's not fun. You don't see it coming, you can't brace yourself.
When did you get sucker punched, Richie?
I'd like to hear more about that story.
That was a couple of years ago.
We'll talk about that off air.
We talk about it off air.
Richie, I'll take care of him. Tell me where he lives, Rich. I'll take care of him.
But I've been sucker punched before in front of the net, and I got a concussion from it, and it's not fun. But, you know, you're lucky to not have something like that happen. Todd Bertuzzi is a big boy, and he's a strong guy. But again, the way, just odd the way he's handled it in terms of not being more active in dealing with it.
Who would sucker punch Richie? That's what I want to know.
More guys than I'm comfortable
with. It's a separate issue altogether. Yeah. Let's go to break. When we come back, one final segment. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN 1290.
You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
I guess Stevens, the captain saw it.
Yeah, Stevens must have seen it. And he's going out there to talk, or send Halik out to talk. They're going to bring the stretcher out. And Stevens knows what happened. Niedermayer doesn't. And the doctors are trying to make sure he's all right. Stevens is really hot.
Oh, yeah. Stevens got his elbow.
Ty Domi, I think, is the one who delivered the elbow. Let's have a look. Niedermayer going into the Leaf zone deep. And then he turns to come back. And Domi just crunches him with an elbow right down there, and there's
the doctors, the three Leaf doctors were out attending to him, and they have ordered
another on-ice incident. We talked about it as we're continuing our conversation about the Steve Moore, Todd Bertuzzi. That was obviously Ty Domi on Scott Niedermayer. Domi did that one, and of course the more famous, or I guess equally famous one, is the one on Ulf Samuelsson in front of the net. Where he just
People didn't feel as bad for Ulfie Samuelsson as he did for Scotty Niedermayer.
Well, Ulfie Samuelsson
ended a few careers.
Yeah, ended a few careers. Cam Neely was, I think, applauding Ty Domi for that hit on Ulf
Samuelsson. But he was
not not applauding, but he wasn't shedding any tears for Ulf Samuelsson.
Ulfie looks great though, and assistant coach with the Rangers now. It looks like he could still play.
Hopefully, a slightly cleaner level of play than it was.
Kids even coming
son
up.
Son Henrik
system,
drafted by the Coyotes. Yep. What's funny actually, because Max Domi's also drafted by the Coyotes.
Oh.
Little Domi Samuelson.
Nice
I wonder if they ever joke about that. They probably do.
My guess is probably, I don't know. It might be one of those sensitive issues you just don't bring up.
Yeah, it's
true. But, you know, obviously it's, as we mentioned, we're talking about Steve Moore and the Todd Bertuzzi incident, the 10-year anniversary coming up today, in fact, and the trial will go to, it will go to trial coming up in September of this year. You know, at this point in time, you know, you mentioned that you never really, you know, that Todd Bertuzzi should have done more. You know, Ty Domi is still quite beloved in, you know, for despite his on-ice incidences. Is that because you think he expressed, the appropriate amounts of regret after the fact, or just, you know, why the difference between the two?
I think he's just more likable, too. I think he's a more likable guy. Bertuzzi isn't, you know, he's a guy you'll see smile after a goal, but overall he's not one of those big, you know, big happy guys. He seems pretty reserved for the most part, and it just, you know, I realize that there's a trial pending and stuff. I just, the way he's dealt with it, I'm just surprised at the way he's dealt with it. And, you know, my point I try to make, I've said for the past couple of segments, is being able to, for the, both these guys to move on. I realize with pending litigation, it's difficult for both of them to move on, but it's also been 10 years. This has been 10 years, and I don't know, you know, driving this now, we don't know what the settlement discussions and all that, but I think the game has moved on, more or less. Like, the game always moves on, but the game has moved on. It's just these two guys. I mean, Crawford has been in a number of positions, a number of jobs since then. You know, he's coached in Dallas, and he coached, I'm trying to figure out where else, or L.A., coached in L.A. too since that incident, I believe. And then you look at Brian Burke, who's also involved at that time. Brian Burke's been in Anaheim. Brian Burke's been in Toronto. Now Brian Burke's in Calgary. So everybody's kind of moved on from this incident, but it seems to still be hanging over the heads of these two guys.
Do you buy at all that there was a bounty on Steve Moore?
I mean, this is the thing, Drew. I think, do the players talk about, you know, we have to make him answer for what he did in the dressing room? Is it said or is it unsaid? You know what? Maybe both sometimes. But I don't think that even if there is a quote-unquote bounty, nobody in that room thinks a bounty is to knock a guy out and break his neck. I don't think even Todd Bertuzzi wouldn't say that, although it was a stupid decision and obviously an idiotic move by Bertuzzi. But the point is, I think making a guy answer for something is usually hitting him hard, doing different things, but it's never actually injuring him forever. That's never the intention.
Well, at the time, and Sean Fitzgerald wrote about this in the National Post, He quoted Brad May at the time, and he said, and Brad May was talking to the Vancouver Sun at the time, and he said, there's definitely a bounty on his head. I mean, the quote is right there. Sure. That's in print. So there was.
But a bounty is not...
It's a different definition of the bounty.
It's not like the NFL bounty.
Well, even the NFL bounty, I think, was overblown.
Right, no, but I'm just saying, like, the point is, it was revenge, right?
Yeah, they wanted revenge.
So it was revenge. So, I mean, you mentioned Drew in that game. He did fight. He didn't want to fight Todd Bertuzzi. Todd Bertuzzi's big. And it goes back to, you know, Todd Bertuzzi made... It's like, you know, that's why, you know, you should never drink and drive. You never should do that, because all it takes is one thing, bad thing happening, and you can't take it back.
By the way,
an accident happens, you can't take it back, and you can say, I'm sorry, and all this.
Who did he fight that game? Matt Cook?
Yeah, that's exactly who it was. Matt Cook versus Steve Moore was the fight in that game.
So he fights Matt Cook, and Todd Bertuzzi says, no, now you're going to fight me. It's 9-2, and he wouldn't fight him. And again, all it takes is, as Richie mentioned, you don't sucker punch a guy, because something like that is really, it's despicable, and it's irreversible at this point. So again, he can apologize, but Steve Moore doesn't seem like he wants to shake hands and make up.
Cheers. Congratulations.
He's brilliant.
He's a good guy.
And cheers.
No, not good enough. He's a bad boy.
I never seen something like this.
Surprisingly not good.
Ezra Ginsberg, cheers or jeers? Quickly, please.
I got to make this quickly. Shannon Sabados has signed a contract to play in the Southern Professional Hockey League. I forget the name of the team.
In Columbus.
Columbus. So that's awesome. Great for women's hockey. She was playing with the Oilers, I believe, as an emergency fill-in goalie in practice, right? Yeah. So good for her.
I'm just amazed Columbus has two professional hockey teams.
Well, they don't have one. Blue Jackets are okay now. Quick, going to cheer Joe Nieuwendijk, Mike Modano, and Nick Lidstrom, all three getting their number raised to the rafters this week. A classy trio. a dominant trio from the years we grew up, kind of really getting into the game of hockey, and three guys who will be missed from the ice for sure.
I'm going to wrap up Cheers and Jeers, send our best wishes out to Tim Bozon. Tim Bozon is a Montreal Canadiens draft pick. He's playing in the Western Hockey League. He's come down with meningitis. It was announced earlier today. He's been placed in a induced coma to try and help his body fight off the terrible disease. We send our best to Tim Bozon. We send our best to his family. And we hope that it's certainly a long road ahead, but we hope first and foremost that he's able to recover. And his hockey career is second, but we hope that he's able to recover.
Absolutely.
That's it for this Saturday morning in the Illegal Curve Hockey Show here on TSN 1290. Big thank you to our guests, Anthony Sanfilippo and Michael Russo. In case you missed any of the program, it will be available for download on iTunes, on TSN1290.ca, and on our website, IllegalCurve.com. You can follow us on Twitter at IllegalCurve, Facebook.com/IllegalCurve, and our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets and NHL news is IllegalCurve.com. For my colleagues, Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg, for producer Remus and producer Tim, I'm your host, Drew Mindell. If it's Saturday, it's the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Hustler and Lawless are next.
You've been listening to
the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
Catch the Illegal Curve Hockey Show live Saturdays on TSN 1290 and TSN 1290.ca.